Welcome to Through the Corporate Glass, a podcast that explores career choices. Welcome to another episode of Through the Corporate Glass. I'm your host, Ashwini. Have you ever wondered what the field of linguistics involves? What are the various opportunities in the field? And what does research in linguistics look like? Is it purely theoretical or is there an experimental aspect? How does one delve into interdisciplinary research and what are the challenges there? To learn about all of this and to uncover an extremely interesting career journey, we chat with Maithili Menon, an associate professor of English and linguistics at Wichita State University, Kansas. Maithili directs the Menon Lab. She's the director of linguistics at Wichita State, director of CETAL, the Center for Educational Technologies to Assist Refugee Learners, and an associate editor of the Journal of South Asian Linguistics. Her research is interdisciplinary, and she collaborates with linguists, computer scientists, speech pathologists, education specialists, game designers, and psychologists. She is the recipient of 2 university faculty awards at Wichita State University, the Young Faculty Risk Taker Award, given to faculty who experiment outside the norm in teaching, research, and service, and the Young Faculty Scholar Award, given to faculty who have records of excellence in teaching performance and substantial achievement in research. Welcome to our podcast, Maithili, and thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you so much, Ashwini, for having me here today. I'm excited to chat.
Awesome. I'm going to go a little back in time and ask you, when did you make the decision to pursue linguistics and how did you even get interested in this field?
So, well, full disclaimer, I was always not interested in linguistics, or I didn't really know what linguistics was. So I was always interested in languages. Having grown up in India, I think it's something that a lot of people have this very nuanced understanding of what it means to speak multiple languages. And very often we, as Indians, we code switch between languages really easily. And you know, we code mix, we put in multiple languages together when we speak. And that always fascinated me as a kid. I always would wonder, how does the human brain do this so effortlessly, right? Like it just happens in an instance, in 1 second. But I'm pretty sure that the computation that goes beneath what we see, what we hear, is really, really complex, right? So I was always interested in that. And I was doing a master's in Hyderabad, and I was pursuing something called cultural studies, which at that point was very interesting to me. And I had a very different understanding of what cultural studies was, but I did not like it at all. So I had to decide, okay, what do I want to do? I'm in this program. I'm in a master's program for cultural studies in Hyderabad. What can I do next? And so I just sat in a linguistics class in my second semester of my master's, which was a syntax class by Professor Amrita Valli, and I fell in love with it. That's one of my favorite classes of all time. It changed my career. It changed my journey as a linguist. And that's really when I became a linguist. And I knew that linguistics was what I wanted to do. So that's really how I got interested in this field.
Oh, that is such a fascinating story for so many different reasons, including the pivot. So generally, when people think of linguistics, I guess what you associate it with is an academic career. How did you view it? And do you think there are any other avenues for people who might be interested in this?
Yes, and that's a really good question, Ashwini, because very often people have this one-track idea that if I have a linguistics degree, I have to become a professor. And we all know that professor positions are really hard to come by, especially in today's world. When I mentor my students, this is what I always tell them. Look for a career outside academia because it's so hard to find a career in academia. And then the question that I immediately get is this, what are my other avenues? What do I do? So there are a lot of different career opportunities for a linguist. There are a lot of industry opportunities. I have a lot of friends who did their PhDs with me and decided not to go into academia. And I have friends who went into academia, did not like it, and decided to go into the industry. So naturally, the things that come into my mind is work for Apple, Google, well, Meta, etc. So a lot of what linguists do with Google is with AdWords. We get a lot of linguistic students who apply to Google positions in AdWords groups. That's an avenue if you're interested in that. With Apple, of course, Siri, there's a lot of speech language processing that goes on with Siri, with Meta, things to do with content or advertisements and all that kind of thing is, again, anything that has to do with text and analysis of text and discourse is really where you see a linguist coming in. So those are industry avenues that kind of come to my mind. But there are also other avenues like publishing and editing. If that's an interest, a lot of my students actually combine linguistics with creative writing. So they take a couple of classes in creative writing. So they get motivated into going into publishing, proofreading, editing texts, and working on publishing books and large scale kind of digital publications and that kind of thing. So the avenues are really quite widespread.
That is actually very, very enlightening because I hadn't thought of all of those as different options for linguistics. So it feels like there are a lot of allied fields.
Right, right. And especially right now with machine learning and natural language processing really coming to the forefront, there's a lot of scope if you want to do linguistics, especially computational linguistics, and kind of, you know, take a couple of classes maybe in computer science, do a little bit of programming, and then combine the linguistic side with that.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, for those of us who actually don't know much about linguistics, your primary research is around syntax-semantics interface. So could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. So this is what I have spent majority of my career working in, my research. Syntax has to do with how we combine different words to create sentences or larger structures of meaning. And semantics is the meaning component of it. So how do we understand meaning when we listen to a word or when we listen to a sentence? So my research has been on the intersection of syntax with semantics, so form and meaning. And the one big question that I've asked within that domain is about adjectives and how adjectives are actually formed in languages that do not actually have adjectives. So, for example, in a language like English, English is an adjective-heavy language, and so you have a lot of different adjectives. For example, you can say, this girl is tall, or this girl is beautiful, and tall and beautiful are adjectives in English. But you can also say something like, this tall girl, or the beautiful girl, where you have the adjective beautiful kind of modifying the noun, right? In this case, the girl. Yeah. But what about languages that actually don't have adjectives? And there are a lot of languages that actually don't have adjectives. So we call these kind of expressions where you have some kind of a quality being predicated onto an individual as property concepts, because really what we are doing is we are taking a property and we are saying that this individual has that property. The girl is beautiful. Mm-hmm. So what I've asked is, if you don't have an adjective, if your language does not have the means, the morphology to kind of say beautiful, how do you express beautiful? I mean, all languages have ways of expressing it. It's just that there are different ways of doing it. And so that's what I've kind of looked at the most, the syntax semantics interface. So I'm currently writing a book on that. I have a book contract with Walter de Gruyter Mouton, which is a German publishing company. A lot of that work is actually going to come out in a book format, probably next year.
Wow, that's exciting. kudos to you for being able to explain it so articulately to people like me who actually don't understand linguistics. Many a time when I'm trying to explain something that I do, which I feel is like really technical, I'm very kind of hard up for words. So
yeah, I mean, believe me, this is something that I've done a lot because nobody understands linguistics. So I think I have had quite a number of turns in practice with it. So probably that's why it's a little easier.
I'm also curious. So is there an experimental angle to the research? Because I did notice you had some work on cognitive and musical processing. And you were trying in particular to pursue the relation between music and language. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so music has been something that I've been interested in ever since I was a child. I started learning Carnatic classical music when I was 3 years old. Never liked it at that point because all I wanted to do was to go outside and play in the sun. But in retrospect, it's something that my mother gave me a lifelong love for music, which I think, you know, the older I am right now, I kind of understand why that was important at that point. But music has always fascinated me and language has always fascinated me. And, you know, when you look at it, these are two things that we as human beings just interact with on a daily basis. Every day we talk, every day we listen to music. I wanted to study the intersection between language and music because I was interested in, okay, well, how does language interfere with music and how does music interfere with language? And I'll tell you really why I found the connection between language and music really fascinating. I sing and I sing in multiple different languages. And when I sing in these languages, when people hear it, they're like, oh, do you speak that language? Like, you sound so good. Do you understand everything that you sing? And I'm like, no, I don't. I mean, I know that this is the lyrics. I memorized it and I can sing it. Being a linguist, I can kind of, I know phonetics and I know speech, right? And speech sounds. So my accent is pretty, you know, accurate in languages that I actually don't speak. But apart from that, I cannot speak a single word or a single sentence in that language. That was really fascinating to me. I was like, how can I sing in 10 different languages, but not speak any of those languages? There should be some connection, some deeper kind of link between language and music. My secondary kind of research interest is psycholinguistics. So psycholinguistics is the branch of linguistics, which actually deals with psychology and linguistics. That's why it's called psycholinguistics. And it's an experimental field. So very often you do experiments. Experiments are very common. It's a norm in psychology. And that's what we do in psycholinguistics. We have some hypotheses. We design an experiment. Usually it's a human subject research. So we get participants to come into the lab. We have computer monitors with the game or the experiment setup or whatever the design of that particular experiment looks like. For the language and music one, what we had participants do was they would come into the lab and they would listen to musical pieces that we created either on the piano or on a guitar. And we would manipulate it for certain conditions that we were looking for. And then we would ask them to complete a task in English. We would give them a sentence and we would ask them to complete something. And we had a hypothesis. So depending on the musical condition that they listened to, we predicted that they would complete the English sentence in a particular way. And what we found out was that, yes, there is this priming effect is what we call it. Priming is basically if there is a particular structure that you have listened to once, you are more likely to produce it again, right? Because that structure kind of stays in your cognition. So that's kind of what we found out, that if you listen to a particular kind of musical structure, you are more likely to use that similar structure in the language task that we have asked you to do. We see that there is this connection between language and music. And of course, you know, we are still very much at the kind of surface. We kind of have a lot of work left to do with musical cognition and understanding of language and music and the intricate relationship between the two. But this is something that, like I said, it's always been a lifelong passion of mine. And I hope I get some funding and I continue this research.
Yeah, this is actually very interesting. And it's interesting that you mentioned what intrigued you was the fact that you could sing in a language that you don't actually speak. I think many of us do this, but we haven't really sat back and thought about it so much. Amazing. I can also relate to your point about doing an experiment and having the structures kind of overlapping. Like I remember back in school, we had to do Hindi as like a second language, and you had to write essays in it. And
right.
my essays would mirror the language that you would encounter in a movie, probably the favorite.
Right. Because that's what's in your head. Yeah.
You direct the Center for Educational Technologies to assist refugee learners. Can you tell us about that center?
Yes. The Center for Educational Technologies to Assist Refugee Learners, we call it CETAL for short. It's a more recent research of mine. So I've been working on this center for the last 3 years, and the center was funded through a three-year grant funding. And it is an interdisciplinary center. We have expertise from very many different disciplines. And the idea is for a lot of different disciplines and a lot of different experts to come together to solve a really crucial problem in education, namely that we have a lot of refugee and asylee children in America, yet these children are actually failing behind and falling behind their American peers. For a variety of reasons, including the fact that a lot of them have been out of school districts for a number of years in refugee camps. Many of them come with trauma and PTSD because they have fled their home country. Some of them have seen their parents die in front of their eyes. And some of them, they don't know the language. I mean, many of them don't speak English. And so, you know, you're coming in when you are 13 years old, 14 years old into this country, and you go into the public school system, which is entirely in English, but you don't know any English. So how are you going to cope? I mean, you have to learn the language, but at the same time, you also have to learn all your school curriculum. You have to learn your science. You have to learn your math. The biggest project that we're working on in CETAL is called Project Education for All. So it's basically addressing the issue of providing equitable and accessible education for all learners. And what we are doing, one step to closing that inequity gap, is to create a bilingual digital game-based learning platform. We call it Gorilla Bay, because majority of refugees in Wichita come from the Democratic Republic of the Congo or from Africa. So that's why we kind of based it out of an African kind of landscape. And the game has four different modules. The aim of the game is to teach middle school science to refugee kids. But we also have a secondary goal, which is to teach them English through their own home language. So we kind of have two goals with this digital game-based learning platform. We have four different modules. The first module is the solar system. Second is the human body. Then we have habitat and ecosystem module. Our latest module is the physics module. Each module, which lasts about 20, 25 minutes, take a role-playing avatar kind of model of the game. So the child or the participant has entire autonomy in interacting with a non-playing character. We call that non-playing character a scientist, Dr. Kayembe. Dr. Kayembe gives different quests, and the participant has to go around the island and finish the quests and bring that back to Dr. Kayembe and get rewarded for it. And in the end, they will also take a quiz to kind of see what they've learned. So that's the overall goal of the project. We're trying to have a partnership with Wichita Public Schools, where we want to beta test it across the school year, where the refugee students give us some feedback. We improve our modules, incorporate that feedback. The game is playable in many different languages, but we are beta testing it in Kiswahili, which is the language spoken by the children from Africa, majority of the children from Africa. We're also beta testing this in Pashto for Afghani refugees and in Arabic for our Syrian and Egyptian refugees. We also have other kind of projects such as Cybersecurity for All and Building Bridges, which is an adult and child literacy project.
The social impact of this work is going to be tremendous. And it's also amazing that you chose to use gamification, I'm guessing, to engage the children and to make it interesting as well for them.
Yes. Yeah. So I think why we chose gamification was because we know that games provide a safe space for children, and these children really need a safe space. So when they come into the school system, they're expected to integrate, but I mean, they look different. They are culturally different. They're linguistically different. And we know that those differences can lead to other issues, right? Like other serious issues such as bullying or xenophobia, etc. And when when we create this safe kind of platform for children to engage with and learn, I think we're taking away a lot of that stress and anxiety away from them.
That's amazing. All the very best on that project.
Thank you.
I also love how interdisciplinary your approach is. I mean, essentially, I can see so many different areas coming together here. And you, of course, never cease to amaze. So I did notice you also have research in the area of cybersecurity. I mean, you have one of your initiatives, which is funded by the NSF, to study social engineering attacks targeting vulnerable refugee populations. Could you
Yeah.
talk about that?
This is kind of an offshoot of CETAL and my 3-year-long work with the refugee community, because I interact a lot with these refugee families who resettle in Wichita. So we've been collecting survey data, we've been collecting focus group interviews, it's communication and conversation with this community. And one of the things that came to the forefront was how refugees actually have a very different understanding of cybersecurity and privacy, right? Now, even as people who have lived in the US for a number of years or were born in the US and brought up here, we get scammed. I mean, there are scam emails and scam phone calls that come almost daily. And sometimes some of them are really sophisticated and it's very difficult for us to identify it. So what are the linguistic traits behind phishing emails or phishing calls? What are these traits that actually make somebody who is an unsuspecting user and an unsuspecting vulnerable user, such as a refugee population, because the refugee population have had long-standing history of giving personally identifiable information to organizations. When the United Nations asks you for your date of birth, you're immediately giving them your date of birth because, hey, if that is going to give you a roof above your head, I will give you anything you ask me. So they have been giving out social security. They don't have a social security number until they come to the US, but whatever is the equivalent of a social security number when they're in a refugee camp or some kind of an identifiable number, right? Date of birth or bank accounts or whatever, any password, any privately identifiable information to agencies. And we know that a lot of this is linked to human trafficking, you know? There are a lot of other kind of repercussions of giving out this privately identifiable information, especially when a socially engineered attack is happening. A lot of the social engineering attacks they target these kind of vulnerable populations because they know that these are spear phishing campaigns and attempts, right? So we really wanted to study. This is a collaboration with University of Texas San Antonio, my collaborator and partner, Dr. Murtaza Jadliwala. He is an expert on cybersecurity and privacy. My expertise is in social science and with CETAL, my work with the refugee population. And so we came together. This NSF-funded project was to bring a social scientist and a computer scientist together to solve an issue which computer science alone cannot solve. A lot of people don't really study the social angle of cybersecurity and phishing, but it's, to use a word that you used earlier, Rashini, it has a social impact. So we really wanted to study the linguistic traits and the linguistic strategies behind some of these phishing campaigns targeting refugee population. So what we have been doing with that, I can't tell you in detail what we're trying to do, but the first step that we have been trying to do is to actually conduct digital literacy workshops with the refugee community, because we do know that digital literacy within this community is poor. Something as simple as switching on a tablet or switching on a laptop, which is a no-brainer for you and me, is it takes a while for them to learn that. Many of them come from poor literacy. So that kind of translates into their digital literacy skills. And therefore, even just typing their name on a phone or typing up their email, answering an email, it's difficult for them. And so we've been trying to do these digital literacy workshops to improve their digital literacy skills. We're going to do our experiment, and then we are going to bring them all back for an educational workshop at the end.
Amazing. That is really fantastic. Your research actually spans so many different fields. It's just amazing to see the breadth of fields that your overall research actually spans. But I wonder, were there any roadblocks or challenges initially when you kind of decided to pursue some of these adjacent fields despite specialization in linguistics?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of linguists are actually, they focus on one field, if at most two fields. This is what we call our core specialization. So for me, that would be my syntax semantics interface and my psycholinguistic research. But I've been very fortunate to be at a university that actually really embraces interdisciplinary collaborations and collaborations across different silos. Because as academics, we tend to work in silos, right? It's something that a lot of us are actually guilty of doing. But it's not always that this kind of interdisciplinary collaborations are encouraged or embraced by universities as well, because people can get territorial and departments can get territorial and resources are so hard, especially in humanities. We try to hold on as much as we can to what we have. But I've been really fortunate and really lucky to be in a department where nobody has said, why is she doing something which is just so out there, right? Or something which is just not her core competency. And my university really, really embraces that. So I've been really fortunate. I can say that there have been roadblocks in terms of, like I said, working across two disciplines always is challenging because the way that humanities works is definitely not the way that engineering works, definitely not the way that health sciences works. And so there's always challenges in terms of, you know, okay, well, if we are writing this article up, what format do we use, right? Or what do we highlight? And what statistical tools do we use? And is that common in your field versus my field? There are all those kind of questions that we need to ask and we need to iron out. But every time I've collaborated with somebody, I've learned something new. And all my collaborators are the brilliant people. They have expertise that I don't have. And I think really that coming together and putting together two different expertise or three different expertise really is the way to move fields forward because nothing happens in a vacuum. A lot of problems that we are trying to address, especially societal problems, really need that kind of synergy and synergistic multimodal kind of effort.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the power that it brings having people from different domains working on one problem together is just phenomenal. Now, you didn't stop with academic research either. You also advise early stage startups about developing education software. How did you decide to delve into that?
Well, some of these startups that you mentioned actually reached out to me. So it's very often it's kind of like a consulting role. They need some kind of advice on the linguistic side of things. And then they kind of, I think, come to my website or see my profile and be like, okay, well, she might have that expertise to kind of advise us. It's something that I've done in the past. I no longer do it, just to be very clear. But, you know, it's very humbling, I think, to see a different perspective because, I mean, a lot of these companies actually use linguistics, but not in the way that I am used to thinking about linguistics. And so I really get to see linguistics actually in the field. I kind of get to see, okay, well, this is how they want to use linguistics and apply it to a field, which is fascinating to me because I've been a theoretical linguist.
So you have like the hardcore deep research, you have the interdisciplinary research, you have social impact, and then you also see like the impact of your work on industry. Fascinating. What would you like to leave our listeners with, Maithili, especially folks who are considering a career in linguistics?
Yeah, I mean, be curious. That's always the advice that I give any of my students when I mentor them. Be curious, always keep an open mind. You never know what you stumble upon, right? It could be a very small idea that you have while you're walking or you're driving or you're just sitting in a chair and daydreaming or something. But no idea is too small and no idea is too big. And if you really put your mind towards getting that idea on the ground and working towards achieving whatever you want to achieve with that idea, sometimes you amaze yourself. And the only way to get there is if you stay curious and you be curious about where that idea is going to take you. Let that idea guide you and take you along to wherever that idea wants to go and flourish and bloom into something bigger.
That's a fantastic way to leave the episode as well. Thank you so much, Maithili. You are a huge inspiration. And it's amazing how every time I meet you, you're doing like a whole new bunch of things.
Thank you, Ashwini. Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, it's been so much fun to chat with you today. And thank you so much for inviting me to be on this podcast.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you enjoyed our episode, do subscribe to the podcast and check out our show notes, which provide more information on the topics discussed during the episode. Please follow us on LinkedIn at Through the Corporate Glass and on Twitter at Corporate Glass and share your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our website, throughthecorporateglass.com.